We're in the 54th chapter of Isaiah, and we've gotten down to the 11th verse, and so we're going to begin with the 11th verse. Beginning with this 11th verse, he is promising future stability and glory to his people, and this is just a continuation now of his promising them that they're going to be released from the captivity. He is going to be their God, and he will never do this again to them like he has done by taking them into Babylonian captivity. And so he begins by saying, "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted." Now this is talking about his people, those that have been in the captivity. They're called, "O thou afflicted." That's a phrase that's applied to them, a description of them as a result of their trials and afflictions. "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest." Now, a tempest is a wind, and it's usually something that you think of on a body of water in which there's a ship there that's being tossed with the storm and the waves of this tempest. And so this is the way he's referring to his people. They have been like a ship that's been tossed with a tempest. That is, it didn't have any stability. It didn't have any security. And it was in great danger of completely being lost. Tossed with tempest. And then, and not comforted. That was another result of their captivity. They were not comforted. God truly did let them endure the rigors and the tortures of this captivity, and they were not comforted. And so it is with us today. When we have to undergo trials and temptations, and whenever we are chastised of the Lord, it's going to be something that's very real. It's not just play-like. It's not something that just can be laughed off and doesn't have any kind of bearing or effect on us, but it's going to be very real trial and temptation, and something that's going to shake us to the very foundation of our existence. And there will be times in which we will not be comforted, in which we can be referred to as "thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted." So that's the way he's addressing his people now. This is the phrase and the titles that he's applying to them as a result of this captivity that they've been in. "O thou afflicted, tossed with tempest, and not comforted, behold, I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundation with sapphires." Now he is referring to the fact that he is going to establish them. He's going to build a great city, a great place here in which they're going to be allowed to live. And of course, the immediate fulfillment of this, and temporal fulfillment, is the church, the temple at Jerusalem. And he did eventually rebuild this temple. And then a greater fulfillment of that was the establishment of the church. And it too is a great building and a spiritual building in which God lives and in which God's people form the parts of. And then even a greater fulfillment than that is going to be the heavenly city in Jerusalem, in which we have a very similar description given of it in Revelation, the 21st chapter. But let's notice what he says now. "I will lay thy stones with fair colors, and lay thy foundation with sapphires." To lay thy stones with fair colors really teaches that the cement or the mortar, which is used to hold the stones together, would be composed of fair colors. And so one of the basic things that we understand about this building is that the mortar that holds the stones together is going to be beautiful. It's going to have what he calls here fair colors. Now, whether this will be just a color or whether it will be precious stones that are ground up to form a part of the mortar, it's not possible to say for sure, but this is the description that he gives of it. "And lay thy foundations with sapphires." Now, a sapphire is a precious stone that is second in hardness only to a diamond. It is either clear or it may be found in a variety of colors. And so we can see then that the foundation is going to be a very firm and secure foundation, to be something that's almost as hard as a diamond to be used for the foundation. And he's really talking about the future beauty and stability of the church. Now in verse 12, "And I will make thy windows of agates, and thy gates of carbuncles, and all thy borders of pleasant stones." Let me remind again that this description here is very similar to what is said in the 21st chapter of Revelation, and it is a description of God's holy city that he is preparing for his people. And so these two run pretty well parallel with each other. But this is a description given to God's people while they were in captivity, and he's promising them that he's going to let them out of captivity. And this is a part of the promise of their future glory and stability. So in verse 12, "I will make thy windows of agates." Now this word here for windows probably doesn't really mean windows as such, but it means ornaments like the sun, or ornaments that give forth light. And windows of agates, the word agates refers to gems of many varieties, which constitute many figures and have many colors. They are the least valuable of the precious stones, but they are in a very great variety. "And thy gates of carbuncles." Now the word carbuncle refers to a gem that is of a deep red color. It looks like a burning coal when it's held up to the sun. "And all thy borders of pleasant stones." So you can see he's talking about that the fact that he is going to build this city, and it's going to be made of precious stones, and it's going to be a very, very pleasant and desirable place to be and to look upon, and something that holds a lot of anticipation in the future as we look forward to it. Now here again, there are lesser and greater fulfillments. As he promised his people, he was going to build them a temple and a city that would be so magnificent that they would never want for anything any better. Jerusalem was a type of that. The church today is a type of that. And yet we still look for new heavens and a new earth in the future, which are going to even yet be a greater fulfillment and a greater type of this. Verse 13, "And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children." Now here's still another part of this promise. Not only now is he talking about the physical building, but he's getting into another area of thy children. "They shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children." That is, they're going to be instructed in the ways of God. They're not going to be ignorant of God and of his ways. They're not going to be disobedient to God. They're not going to be somebody that you'd be ashamed of, but they're going to be taught of God. Now, for anybody or any group to be taught of God, this is a very important situation, to be taught of God. For this means that you then have a degree of education and understanding and insight that is over and beyond the average natural man. You have gotten into the spiritual realm, and you are able then to have prudence and understanding and wisdom, and you can so guide your life and your activities accordingly, and you can be then holy like God's holy. Thy children shall be taught of God, and great shall be the peace of thy children. That is, your children are not going to be running around in a turmoil like the rest of the world, but you're going to have a source of peace and understanding and security that the rest of the world does not have. Great shall be the peace of thy children. Now, God has made this promise in other places. He made this promise to the church and about the church. In Jeremiah 31, verse 31, he gives this promise like this: "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in that day when I took them by the hand to bring them up out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my law in their inward parts, and write it in their hearts, and will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more. Now that is a promise given by God and Jeremiah. And here again he says it in our verse today in Isaiah. And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children. That truly is being fulfilled in the church. For in the church age, no one becomes a child of God without knowing God. Now, this is contrary to the teaching and practice of many, I know. But you have to know God before you can become a child of God. And consequently, once you know God then, and you are added into that kingdom, one man doesn't turn to his neighbor and say, Know God, know the Lord. For they shall all know me, he says, from the least to the greatest. All in the kingdom know him, because they have to know him in order to be able to get into the kingdom. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. And so this is a fulfillment of this prophecy. We do not have people added to the church who are not fully aware of what they're doing. It is a rational and intelligent decision on their part to do so. And consequently, they know God before they get there. Now, in verse 14, In righteousness shalt thou be established. Thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. So in righteousness shalt thou be established. That is, we're going to be established as the people of God in a way that is filled with righteousness. They're not going to be flaws in the law of God. There are not going to be areas there that really are not good laws. We're going to have nothing but good laws. And we're going to be following those laws so that we will be according to them and we'll be according to righteousness. Now, another way you can look at this is that as long as you stay in righteousness, you shall be established. You're going to be secure. You're going to be firm. You're not going to be forsaken or have God to hide his face from you again. As long as you stay in righteousness, you'll be established in righteousness. This is the hallmark of our security, of our safety, of our defense, as it were, our righteousness. In righteousness shall you be established. And as a result of this, then, being established in righteousness, thou shalt be far from oppression, for thou shalt not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near thee. While you're in righteousness. Now, when you get out of righteousness, though, when you're no longer following righteousness, then this rule ceases to apply to you because you're not in righteousness anymore. Behold, verse 15, they shall surely gather together, but not by me. Now, they shall surely gather together refers to those who are going to turn against the church, who are going to want to cause oppression to it. And this is stated again in Psalms 2, verse 2. He says, The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Now, that's what the kings of the earth and the rulers decide to do. They want to take counsel together and set themselves against the Lord and against his anointed. And so here he says, Behold, they shall surely gather together. Now, anytime you're doing something that is according to what God wants, you're going to be out of step with and out of harmony with the majority of the rest of the world. You're automatically a minority group, and as a result of that, you're going to be spoken against, and you're going to be criticized and ridiculed, and you're going to have those who are going to try to tear down your position and your philosophy and way of life. Now, this is going to happen. Behold, they shall surely gather together. Now, this is surely something that's going to happen. Even though God has protected you and God has taken you out of captivity and he's done all these things he said he's going to do, still he, right along with that, tells you that they're going to be gathered together and it's going to be against you. But he says, but not by me. That is, it'll not be his doing. He's not causing them to gather together against you. He's not blessing it. He's not wanting it to happen. He's not making it happen, but he's predicting that it will happen. Whosoever shall gather together against thee shall fall for thy sake. Now these are the forces of evil against the church and against individual members of the church. He says they shall fall for thy sake. Now this can be interpreted two ways. Now, one is they shall fall in order to preserve you, in order to allow you to stand. They're not going to be successful in being able to annihilate you. That's one way to look at it. Or this could mean that they shall fall into your power. That is, they're going to be converted to the gospel. And there are some translations that lean towards that interpretation of this. They shall fall for your sake. And we do know, as we said earlier, that each of the nations that were in existence at the time of the church, when the church was first established, those nations no longer continue to stand, but they've all been changed and replaced by other nations. Now, as further security here of our position, in verse 16 he says, "Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy." Now, this verse is simply saying that God is the one who created the smith that makes the instruments of war, the instruments of destruction. All of these people who are making the weapons of war, when you look at it, get right down to it, God created these people. God allows these people to breathe and to exist and to move and to do the things that they do. He allows them to do these things. "I've created the waster to destroy." And truly, war is a waste. It is the height of man's folly. And anytime you see two nations engaged in war, you see nothing but waste and absolute destruction, and no productivity or creativity comes from that at all. Well, since God can control these people who make these weapons, he certainly can control the weapons that they make, so you can see then how that he is capable, he is able to protect us. He has that ability because he is the one who lets these people even exist. He could wipe them off of the face of the earth if he simply wanted to do it. And so when it comes right down to it, then there is no power, there is no destructive force that man can devise that God cannot counteract and cause us to be protected from. That's what he's really saying. And this was bound to have been important back during the days of Isaiah, when this prophecy was given, and they truly had been wiped out as a nation and carried away into captivity, and they could be made to realize, well, God just let these people do this, and God surely can overcome them because he is greater than they are. But it's even more important, I think, to us today as we stop and think of the great and terrible weapons that man is able to make today. Such things as the hydrogen bomb, and no telling what other weapons are on the drawing boards and in the minds of the scientists and are within the range of the capability of modern technology, weapons that can certainly completely destroy all life on this earth if they were allowed to be unleashed, and we can become terrified of this and become very insecure and worried and wonder how this or that or the other is going to take place. But when we stop and think, God made these people. He made all these scientists. They're following laws that are according to his laws of science and physics and mathematics and chemistry. And consequently, then God can control them. God has the power over them. And so this is what he's saying here. When he says, verse 16, "Behold, I have created the smith that bloweth the coals in the fire, and that bringeth forth an instrument for his work, and I have created the waster to destroy." In verse 17, "No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper." Now that's what he's talking about. Man's not going to be able to make anything against you that can prosper, that can really, really wipe you out, that can really annihilate the church. The church is going to be able to stand in the light of all of these problems. The church will be allowed to stand. And one real good example of it was the destruction of the city of Jerusalem, which came centuries after this prophecy was given. And when that city was destroyed, the church had been forewarned and been prepared as to what to do, and they were told to get up and to flee and to get out of the city and go to the mountains. And they did the very thing that God told them to do, and they were preserved. The city was destroyed, and the people were just slaughtered. Blood was running in the streets. But God's people, the church, the true church, was saved from that. So God is smarter than any of the weapons of man, any of the wizardry of man. And he is able to preserve his people. That's simply what he's saying here. God can and will. He will preserve, he will guard, he will protect you. So verse 17 says, no weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper. And every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment, thou shalt condemn. Now here's another element to the enemies of God's people who would try to destroy them, is the use of the tongue. Every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment, thou shalt condemn. There are people who bring up all kinds of doctrines that are contrary to the church now. They're contrary to the teaching of God. They have arguments and philosophies and ideas that are designed to tear down the true doctrine, that are designed to counteract the true teachings of God's people. And they're going to be brought to bear against God's people. There are going to be times in which you're going to have some of these arguments turned against you, when you're going to be called upon to defend your position, to defend your teaching and your practice, to defend why you're teaching others these things. And you're going to be ridiculed, and you're going to be called to task for what you teach, and you're going to be brought to judgment by their tongues. But he says, every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment, thou shalt condemn. You're going to be able to counter it. You're going to be able to defend yourself. You're going to be able to give a teaching from God's Word that will verify, that will condone, that will substantiate what you're teaching and what you're practicing, if you're truly in righteousness. Now, let's go back to verse 14. In righteousness shalt thou be established. Now, when we step outside of the realms of righteousness, we lose these protections. We're not going to be able to rise against these tongues that are trying to condemn us or that are standing in judgment against us. We're not going to be able to do that if we're outside of righteousness. But if we're in righteousness and we have the truth, then we will have this protection. And he concludes this chapter by saying, this is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. Now, this is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. So when something is a heritage, it is something that you have inherited. It is something that you have gotten by way of having inherited it. So he's talking about this this protection, this fact that you'll be established in righteousness, that you'll be far from oppression. You'll not fear. You'll be far from terror. It'll not come near thee. The fact that those who gather together against thee, that they shall fall for thy sake. The fact that God has created all these people who make these terrible weapons that would be used against you, and God can control them. You've inherited protection from them because God is able to overrule and to overcome them. And every tongue that shall rise against thee, you'll be able to condemn it. You'll be able to stand on God's word. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. And so if we could just stop and take a broad view of this world and of our situation in it as God's people, if we could look at ourselves in the true perspective of these passages of Scripture in which God has made these promises, it would help us then to truly rely on God, to place all of our trust in Him, to continually study His Word, to learn more about it, to be closer to God. It would help us to do that rather than to become frightened and to go off and to try to fight the world with the weapons of the world and to say that, God has forsaken us. Because God has given us a heritage here, something that is ours. And as he finishes this verse, he says, "And their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord." Whatever righteousness God's people have, whatever way they have that's the right way, it comes from God. Now, this is a very important precept in our doctrine. If we depend upon traditions of man, if we depend upon other institutions to give us our righteousness and to show us the way in which we are to live, and we are using things there that do not come from God, that are not a part of God's teaching, and that are not a part of God's heritage, then we have just stepped outside of the realm of this protection because we have put ourselves into a position in which our righteousness is not of God. So we've got to be very careful that our righteousness, that is all of the things that we hold to be a part of our doctrine and practice, a part of our teaching, a part of our very lives, all of those things must come from God, and we must have a thus saith the Lord for it, or we run the risk of having a righteousness that is not of God. He says, "And their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord." Let's read that last verse again. Verse 17. "No weapon that is formed against thee shall prosper, and every tongue that shall rise against thee in judgment thou shalt condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their righteousness is of me, saith the Lord." So it's a very beautiful passage and a very comforting thought to know that this does apply to us. We're going to close at that point. Next time we'll begin with chapter 55, Lord willing. Thank you.